Okay. Case number 132515, Mosley versus Harrington. Oh. Hello, Miss Dorsch. Come on up.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Attorney General Catherine Dorsch on behalf of the respondent warden in this case. The state here had a very strong circumstantial case. The petitioner ordered two juvenile members of his gang to light the fire that killed the elderly victim in this case, beginning with his own inculpatory statements in which petitioner admitted to police that he had argued with the rival drug dealer, Marlo Fernando, on the very day of the fire and, in fact, threatened to burn her out. And that he said, let it burn, or, pardon the indelicate language, let the motherfucker burn two times. It was no coincidence, then, that the fire was set not on the first floor of the building or the third floor of the building, but on the second floor where Fernando lived. And consistent with petitioner's admissions, both Fernando and her friend Ledbetter testified that about the threats, the ongoing threats that petitioner had made against Fernando, as well as that right before the fire, petitioner stopped underneath Fernando's window, looked up, and said, burn the motherfucker down. And the juveniles who set the fire had also given statements inculpating petitioner, but because they were not going to testify, the state had no direct proof that petitioner ordered the juveniles to set the fire. And so defense counsel seized upon this lack of direct proof to formulate a theory of the defense, that the state could not prove that he had in fact ordered the juveniles to set the fire. Perhaps they did it to curry favor with him, but he did not order it, and in fact he was across the street at the time of the fire and didn't come across again until after the building was already in flames. So counsel put on a witness who testified consistent with that theory of the defense. Ishikawa testified that petitioner was in fact across the street in the schoolyard all night from approximately 7:30 until after the fire started, that she never heard him make any threats, and he never said let it burn.
Now, of course, Judge Gottschall found that neither Strunk nor the investigator spoke to Taylor. Wouldn't that in and of itself be ineffectiveness? And if so, wouldn't we go straight to prejudice?
Pardon me?
Wouldn't we go straight to the fact that he didn't talk? The fact that Mr. Strunk didn't talk to either...
The fact that Strunk didn't call Fernando. Exactly. That's what Judge
Gottschall found. No, you didn't hear the question.
Okay. Neither Taylor nor Strunk spoke to Taylor. What I'm asking is, wouldn't that in and of itself be considered ineffectiveness? And if it is, don't we go straight to prejudice?
I think we can resolve this on prejudice alone, of course, yes, because the district court judgment is rests on numerous clearly erroneous findings of fact.
So, just so that we're taking this a step at a time, so you agree that the district judge finding of ineffectiveness is appropriate and justified in this case? I mean, Judge Gottschall found, as Judge Rovner pointed
right.
out...
Judge Gottschall found that counsel was ineffective because he didn't call Sharon Taylor. Yeah.
And that's not in dispute.
That's not in dispute, no. That was the judge's finding,
All we need to worry about is prejudice.
Pardon me?
All we need to worry about now is the prejudice element.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
As I was saying, the district court's judgment includes any number. We list five clearly erroneous findings of fact, and respondent, in fact, fails to respond to them and effectively concedes that the district court was wrong to conclude various things about counsel, that counsel wanted to call Fernando but couldn't because he had failed to subpoena her ahead of time. The district court was wrong to conclude that counsel prepared his case based on his belief that the court would reject Fernando's testimony and that he didn't prepare a defense until after his motion for judgment of acquittal was denied.
Is that clearly erroneous? I thought that was pretty evident from Strunk's testimony. He expected the the judge to grant the motion for judgment of acquittal. The transcript indicates that he wasn't prepared to go forward, and he then scrambled to put together a defense. Now, maybe there's a different way to read that, but how is that clearly erroneous?
I think that's an inaccurate characterization of Mr. Strunk's testimony. He said
No. I'm not talking about Strunk's testimony. I'm talking about the district court's findings.
Mm-hmm. But the district court found that he didn't prepare a defense. He was completely, up until that point, he had hoped that the court would reject Fernando's testimony, and he thought he would win on that basis, and he had no defense theory planned at all. And then when the court denied his motion for judgment of acquittal, he had to start coming up with a plan. And petitioners effectively conceded, by not responding to our argument, that that, in fact, was not the case. He did have a theory of the case, and he did have a plan. He expected the court to direct it out because he thought it was sufficient that there was no direct proof that the petitioner had ordered the juveniles to set the fire. But the main problem with the district court's judgment here is his belief that Taylor would have put, her testimony would have put petitioner in the school yet at the time the fire started, which everybody agrees is the critical time period here, because the judge found that while petitioner was saying burn it down, the juveniles were, in fact, that was the direction for the juveniles inside the apartment to light it on fire.
Well, you make a reasonable point when you note that Taylor, in contrast to Coward, would have placed Mosley in the apartment building not long before the fire. But how damaging would that really have been, given that he wasn't alleged to have set the fire himself? As you
counsel felt, it would be very damaging. Because it said, in his estimation, it would have lent weight to the state's evidence that petitioner was, in fact, over there by the building and could have been threatening threatening Fernando yelling
counsel,
right down.
We understand that if the district judge had accepted Strunk's testimony, she would have denied relief, okay? But she didn't. So that's really the foundation you need to work from in terms
that's
of
correct.
Arguing prejudice. And Taylor's testimony was clearly inconsistent, or would have been clearly inconsistent, with Fernando's testimony about the threat from outside underneath the window, right?
Potentially inconsistent, because she said her window was open and she didn't hear a threat, but it doesn't mean he didn't make one, of course. She didn't hear one, and her window is, you know, another story up. So
it's not physically impossible, but it was clearly inconsistent, and that was Judge Gottschall's reasoning, right?
Yes.
And Judge Gottschall also went through, for example, as she had several years ago when she first had the case, why she thought Fernando's story was probably physically impossible in terms of her movement and how quickly the fire started, right? Which would tend to suggest that anything undermining Fernando's shaky testimony might well have made a difference and undermined confidence in the outcome of the trial.
I disagree with Judge Gottschall's sort of assessment of the evidence. Fernando testified that, you know, she and Ledbetter saw a petitioner out the window. They went to the door. They unlocked the scissor bars. They saw Anthony and Matthew, the juveniles, running out of the building at that very moment. So that certainly puts the juveniles in the apartment building very close to the time the petitioner yelled, burn it down. And the other part, that even if Taylor's testimony could put petitioner in the school yet at the time the fire started, there were other infirmities in the testimony, because Taylor's testimony is inconsistent with Coward's, and it would be unreasonable for defense counsel to put somebody on, one witness on, who says petitioner was in the schoolyard for the entire duration of the evening, and Taylor says, well, no, he wasn't. He was in my apartment 45 minutes before the fire.
Well, you know, there are no perfect witnesses, and there are no there shouldn't be exact story, precise, you know, you rarely see exact stories matching. Wasn't it important for the defense to put on more than just one witness, if there is one available? Particularly as to say whether or not to burn the building down. That's very important. Well,
Taylor also testified that there were no females in the schoolyard, which, of course, would definitely undermine Calvert's testimony to the effect that she, of course, as an adult female, was a female, and there were other females in the schoolyard. Simply put, there were just too many inconsistencies that even if the court correctly concluded, and the court did not correctly conclude that Taylor was, could place him in the schoolyard at the time of the fire, even if he could, the court mistakenly failed to also consider the downsides of calling Taylor.
You want to save some time?
Yeah,
you do. Okay, thank you. Mr. Poripaiboon?
Poripaiboon,
thank you.
May it please the court, Keith Poripaiboon for Petitioner Appellee. This court should affirm the district court's judgment. In its 2012 opinion, this court remanded for a determination of whether, based on all the evidence available, Mr. Mosley's trial counsel was constitutionally ineffective under 28 U.S.C. 2254 subsection A. On remand, the district court followed this court's instructions and found that Mr. Mosley was in fact denied the effective assistance of counsel and granted his habeas petition. The state appeals primarily on two grounds. First, the state contends that the district court did not rule under subsection A, but instead ruled under subsection D. While the district court's original opinion did inadvertently make reference to subsection D, it also discussed the problems with Mr. Mosley's trial counsel's performance based on the expanded evidentiary record, specifically finding that it fell below an objective standard of reasonableness and that Mr. Mosley was prejudiced as a result, the two prongs of the Strickland test. Moreover, in response to the state's Rule 59e motion, the district court explicitly ruled that it was granting habeas under subsection A. If Rule 59 is to have any force, this corrective ruling by the district court should stand. Second, the state argues that the facts before the district court are insufficient to show that Mr. Mosley's trial court representation was constitutionally inadequate. The state raises the same arguments that have been already considered and rejected by this court in the state's first appeal and by the district court on numerous occasions. The state points to nothing in the expanded evidentiary record that changes the analysis, and in fact, as the district court ruled, the expanded record actually supports Mr. Mosley's claim that he was denied effective assistance of counsel. These repetitive arguments made in an appeal taken 14 years after Mr. Mosley's trial, should once again be rejected, and this district court's decision should be affirmed so that Mr. Mosley can be retried with constitutionally effective counsel.
You know, Judge Gatchel specifically refrained from making a finding as to whether Strunk was aware of Jones. Absent such a finding, we have to remove her from the mix, and we have to focus on Taylor alone. Given that Taylor placed Mosley in the building shortly before the fire, wasn't there a genuine risk in presenting her testimony as Ms. Dorsch argues, if only because this conflicts with Coward's account?
Well, first, Ms. Coward's account was self-contradictory at points, especially as to the issue of exactly where Mr. Mosley was. She backtracked on whether he left the schoolyard or not. And I think more importantly, Ms. Taylor only puts him in the building 45 minutes before the fire, which is not a really relevant time frame. The relevant time frame is immediately before the fire when he's allegedly outside the building inciting, you know, making the statements that the statement that counsel alluded to earlier. That he was there 45 minutes beforehand really has no bearing on that. And the importance of that is underscored by the trial court on numerous occasions. He relies on the fact that Mr. Mosley allegedly made these statements right before the fire burned. If you read both in the trial transcript and the sentencing, those are clearly material to how he viewed the case. In addition, you know, having Ms. Taylor testify about him being in the apartment building beforehand, 45 minutes beforehand, sort of cuts into the whole theory of why he would have whether he would have started the fire, because he was there to visit with her. He offered to bring her dinner later in the evening. It's inconsistent with him starting a fire that he would have a close friend there and that he wouldn't warn her of the fire. And, you know, that's backed up by the fact that she didn't leave the building until the fire was well underway. And actually,
the fire department that rescued her, right?
Yeah.
The fire department rescued her, and she had to throw her son to Mr. Mosley.
How old was that child?
I believe he was 5 years old at the time. So So based on the full record before, the district court determined that Ms. Taylor was credible, and that's a finding of fact that's owed considerable deference at this point. The district court didn't find the minor discrepancies between Ms. Taylor's affidavit and her testimony to be material to any of the issues in this case, and none of these facts are clearly erroneous. I think the state hasn't shown how any of these minor points from the affidavits change the analysis, the state points to a handful of immaterial discrepancies between the affidavit and the testimony and tries to use those to invalidate all the other evidence that shows that Mr. Mosley received ineffective assistance of counsel. I think most of the evidence of that is actually in the trial transcript, which was before this court and the state court in the first appeal. So the rest of the argument is largely what we argued over in the first appeal, which was the two prongs of Strickland, and I think the state has conceded that Mr. Strunk's performance was fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, so I'll concentrate on the prejudice prong. And I think there's a reasonable probability that Mr. Strunk's performance affected the outcome of the trial. This court has already held that the evidence against Mr. Mosley was not overwhelming, so the verdict was more likely to have been affected by Mr. Strunk's errors. And unusually, I think, in this type of case, the trial court, because it was a bench trial, the trial court actually gave the reasons for its finding, and two things were central. First, that Mr. Mosley was under Ms. Fernando's window inciting the fire, which we've already discussed, and second, that he told the two boys to, quote, burn this motherfucker down. Ms. Taylor's testimony cuts right into that reasoning. She said she was across the street and did not hear the alleged order. And as I said, this is bolstered by the fact that she was in her apartment with her son. If she'd heard any of these threats or the order, it's hard to believe that she wouldn't have immediately fled. To address one point that the state raised, which was that there were a lot of females, or that Ms. Taylor didn't see any females in the schoolyard. She also testified that she couldn't see the entire schoolyard. There was a playground around the corner. And so it's not inconceivable that, you know, that people were walking back and forth. It's hardly indicative of a problem with her testimony to say that she didn't notice everyone who was in the schoolyard at that time. The full record in this case unmistakably shows that the shaky defense that Mr. Strunk put up against a very thin prosecution case, Mr. Mosley received constitutionally ineffective assistance of counsel. The district court's decision should be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Ms. Dorsch, do you want to come back up? You have some time. Two minutes.
Just to make clear that I'm not conceding deficient performance. We make an argument on performance on both Jones and Taylor in our brief, and we rely on that argument. Just focusing on prejudice here because...
So what were we talking about in the first part of your argument?
I understood you to be saying, if, in fact, that she was correct about this, are we focusing on prejudice? But we can dispose of it on prejudice in any event.
Are you arguing now that Strunk provided adequate performance in failing to talk with Taylor?
With Taylor?
Yeah.
Yes, because it's clear that the petitioner's counsel, Mr. Strunk, testified that petitioner told him that Taylor could put him in the schoolyard across the street, and he assumed that meant in the schoolyard, and could probably also testify that he didn't make any threats. And so petitioner counsel was aware of the general substance of
the district court found otherwise. The district court found that Strunk didn't know what Taylor would say.
And we argued that that was incorrect in light of the evidentiary hearing testimony.
Okay. I thought that issue had been put to rest, but
thanks to all parties. Was Tanner and Block appointed? Thank you very, very much for taking the appointment. And thanks to the state as well. And the case will be taken under advisement, like every other case in the history of this court.